Well, good morning and welcome to Focus 580. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is our morning talk program. Before we get going here, one bit of business left over from yesterday that I want to do. Yesterday morning on the program, it was the first Wednesday and has been for a long time our habit to talk about cooking on that day with the man that we like to call our chef in residence, Doyle Moore. And yesterday, he said he was interested in talking about greens and particularly wild greens. And we spent some time talking about that and had a good time as usual. However, we have some listeners that were concerned that some of the information that was given out on the program might be potentially hazardous. And one of the things that we talked about, someone talked about poke, which is a weed and has traditionally, historically been eaten by people in the South. However, the consensus on poke is that it is poisonous. All the parts of the plant, the berries, the leaves, everything about it is poisonous, and we certainly don't want anybody to get sick or get poisoned. So the standard advice now as far as poke is concerned is to leave it alone. Certainly you don't want to eat it. And I think overall our advice would be, as far as wild plants are concerned, please make sure that you know what it is before you eat it, and if you have any doubt, that you leave wild plants alone, because certainly there are things out there in the environment that are poisonous. Probably the safest thing to do if you're interested in having some greens is to go down to the grocery store and buy them. So again, don't eat the pokeweed. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the issue of people coming out of prisons. America's prisons now hold something like a million more people than they did just a generation ago. And as the number of Americans behind bars has increased, so has the number of people leaving prison, which now number something like 700,000 every year. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Jeremy Travis. He is president of John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. And he says that in expanding the use of prisons as our response to crime, we have forgotten the iron law of imprisonment, and that is that they all come back. Let me give you a little bit more background on our guest. Jeremy Travis became president of John Jay College in August of 2004. Before that, he served as a senior fellow affiliated with the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute. Before that, he directed the National Institute of Justice. That's the research arm of the U.S. Department of Justice. Before going to Washington, he was deputy commissioner for legal matters for the New York City Police Department. He served as chief counsel to the U.S. House Judiciary Subcommittee on Criminal Justice. He served as special advisor to New York City Mayor Ed Koch from 1986 until 1989, and also assistant director of law enforcement services for the mayor's office of operations. He's taught courses on criminal justice, public policy, history, and law at Yale, New York University, Wagner Graduate School of Public Service, New York Law School, George Washington University, and also John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And among other things, he's the author of a book that explores this issue. The title of his book is But They All Come Back, Facing the Challenges of Prisoner Reentry. It's published by the Urban Institute Press. Questions and comments are welcome from people who are listening. The only thing we ask of listeners is that people are brief in their comments and questions. And the number to use here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Professor Travis, hello.
Well, good morning.
Well, thank you, and thank you for your patience. I don't recall that ever happening before here in this all the time we've been in this building. Again, touch on something, and this certainly is something that does get coverage in the media, that the United States has a very large number of people behind bars. What's the number, and how does that compare with other countries?
Well, the number is indeed very large, and if you include both those who are in prison, and those are people sentenced to a year or more, and those in jail, either short sentences or awaiting trial, we're well over 2 million people in prison. But it's hard to understand a number like that and put it in context. So here's the way I think it's easier to understand it, which is that as a matter of rate, the per capita rate of incarceration in America, we have quintupled the rate of incarceration since the early 1970s. So we now lead the world in terms of our both our numbers in prison and also the rate of incarceration. We hold about 5% of the world's population and about a quarter of the world's prison population. So we've, over the last generation, made a conscious decision as a country through our legislative branches of government to significantly increase the use of prison as our response to crime. Mm-hmm.
And certainly that presents a number of issues because you have to have the space to house people. You have to have staff. It costs a significant amount of money to do that. So that's one set of issues that have to do with corrections, obviously. And we could certainly talk about that. But the thing that we wanted to focus on was this other part that perhaps doesn't get the amount of attention. I'm sure you would say doesn't get the amount of attention that it should. And that is, what do we do, what, if anything, do we do for people who have been in prison to try to facilitate their reentry into society? And, of course, the goal, the big goal there is that this person not end up in prison again.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you indicated in the introduction, there is what I've termed the iron law of imprisonment. It's a fairly simple, straightforward idea, which is that except for those people who die in prison, either of natural causes or because we execute them, everybody who we send to prison comes back. So all of the increase in imprisonment means an increase in the number of people who have been cycled in and out of our prisons and return home to our communities. So the I think we can with some accuracy call it a movement now, the sort of a movement, reentry movement of people who are focusing on this consequence of the ramp up in incarceration, which is that there are so many more Americans who have a prison experience as part of their lives. And then we start to ask ourselves, you know, some pretty profound questions, which is how do we prepare people for the journey back home? How do we increase the chances of success and reduce the likelihood of failure, particularly reoffending? And over the long term, how do we, as a society, live with millions of our fellow citizens who have been marginalized or stigmatized or in some ways damaged by the fact that they've been in prison?
Mm-hmm. It's something that seems to be the case now is that this problem of reentry it's actually starting to get attention now, more attention than it has. So that invites this question of why in the past did we not pay much attention to that, and then why is it now? Is it simply the fact that we are talking about a large numbers of people coming out of prison, and it's a number that's gotten so big that it's something that we just simply can't ignore?
Well, it's a very profound question because I think it really goes to the heart of the issue, which is America's choice in terms of punishment and prisons, and our almost inclination to want to not deal with the consequences of that choice. But it is true, as you said, that there was a long period of time where there was not much focus on the issues of reentry and reintegration. And over the past 9 years now, there's been a very substantial focus. And this is a question that those of us who work in this area get asked a lot, which is sort of what happened in the late 1990s caused this resurgence of interest. It started, there's a story I tell in the book, when I worked for Attorney General Reno, she asked me after another meeting on another topic, she asked me, what are we doing about all the people coming home from prison? And I had to admit, I didn't have a very good answer, so she directed me to pull together a task force to start to look at it, and we started publishing and writing and sort of causing people to focus on this. I think one answer to the question, and only a partial answer, is that as we faced a really terrifying crime increase in violent crime in the late 80s, early 90s, we as a society, as a country, were very intent upon stigmatizing and in some cases demonizing people who were breaking the law, and there's a lot of fear and concern and insecurity in the country. And then we started in the early 90s to experience this very rapid decline in rates of violence. So I think it became easier in a political sense and in a sort of cultural sense for us to focus on the consequences of our decisions to put many more people in prison because crime rates were lower in the 90s. And there are some other additions. There's an important contribution now being made by the faith community in criminal justice policy. And that community, which has been very active in supporting reentry initiatives, comes at these issues with a very different framework, a different language, a language of redemption and forgiveness and reconciliation. And I think that's helped us as well focus on this inevitable consequence of many more people in prison. Mm.
Let me introduce again, just very quickly, our guest with this hour of Focus 580. Jeremy Travis is the president of John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. He's written widely on constitutional law, criminal justice policy. Before his appointment as president there at John Jay College, he served as a senior fellow with the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute, and there he launched a national research program that looked at this issue of prisoner reentry into society. And he also initiated some research projects on crime in a community context, on sentencing, on international crime. And we're talking here this morning about the issue of prisoner reentry. And that is, once someone has been in prison and they get out, what, if anything, do we as a society do for them to try to help them get integrated into society, get back into life, and reduce the possibility that they're going to jail again? 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. What is the recidivism rate, or is that something that you'd have to say, well, perhaps it maybe depends on what kind of person you're talking about?
Well, of course it does depend. Not everybody fails and not everybody succeeds, so there's some variation within this group. The Bureau of Justice Statistics, which is the federal statistical agency for justice trends, published a study a few years back that asked the question, what percentage of people coming out of state prisons are rearrested for one or more crimes in the 3 years after they're released? And that's a fairly classic measure of recidivism. For 3 years, one or more crimes, what's the percentage rearrested? And the answer to that question in that study was about 67%. So two-thirds of the people who come out of prison fail, if you just define failure as being rearrested. And that is up only a little bit from the last time the BJS did a study in the 80s, and that's fairly constant around the country. People measure things a little bit differently. Sometimes they look only at the rate of return to prison, which is problematic as a measure. But the way I like to look at this is not just at that overall three-year number, but we need to recognize that the rates of failure are highest in the weeks and months after people leave prison. And there's a declining rate of failure over that three-year period. So if you break down the 3 years by time segments, what you realize is that the time of greatest risk of failure is the time right after the prison gates close and somebody goes home. So the reentry conversation that's now so robust around the country is thinking about the recidivism issue in a different way by asking, what can we do to reduce the rates of failure in those early weeks and months? And the resource question, the policy question, is, have we allocated resources where the risk is? If the risk is highest in those first 6 months, 40% of the failures in the first 6 months, are we allocating 40% of all of our resources there to reduce that failure? And are we allocating the right resources? And when you go down that logical chain, you start asking very important questions about transitions, discharge planning, what do people need when they first get out, connecting people back to mental health clinics and to drug treatment and to transitional housing and thinking about family involvement. So the reentry policy conversation, which starts with an answer to your question, what's the failure rate, quickly becomes a very fresh and new and innovative and multi-sector conversation about ways to reduce failure at the early stages of the reentry process.
I have a couple of callers here, and I want to get to them pretty quickly here. I want to promise them I won't make them wait too much longer. But if I could ask this question, if you look at the individuals after they've been released from prison, and I don't know, I suppose there's two ways of asking this question. Either you could ask, what are the biggest risk factors for committing crime again and being rearrested and going back to prison? Or maybe the other way is to say, what factors are positive in the sense that you'd say, well, if we could do this, or if the person had this kind of support, then his chances would of being of reoffending and going back to prison would be much less. Mm-hmm. What are the key things?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that we focus on a lot are health issues, and by that I mean both mental health questions. People coming out of prison have been through a traumatic experience, and many of them, a high percentage, about 16% or 20%, are mentally ill. So the connection back to a mental health care provider for that population is very important. So, and it's states don't always, in fact, rarely provide continuity in terms of medical coverage, Medicaid coverage for mentally ill people. So that's a high on the list. As high on the list is the our connections to drug treatment. There are high rates of relapse for people when they come out of prison. In prisons, although there are drugs in many prisons that are smuggled in and the like, prisons are basically an environment where people can't have access to drugs or alcohol, the things they had on the street. So when they come back, there's often a return to that sort of behavior, which is associated with high rates of return to criminal behavior as well. Family issues are very important. We've learned through the research we've done, I think we've underestimated the importance of family. Families are places both of comfort and conflict. And when we think about reentry and discharge planning, we have to recognize that the family environment that one goes back to can either help or can hurt in terms of the road to reintegration. Employment is a long-term, maybe not immediately, but a long-term important ingredient in the equation here. So there depending on the individual, there will be different components that need attention, and sometimes some things will need more attention in the beginning part of the reentry process, and others will take priority in the latter part of the process.
Mm-hmm. Well, we have some callers here to bring into the conversation, so let us do that. We'll start with someone who is listening in Kankakee County. This is line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like to ask the guest what his thoughts are concerning perhaps that the prison system itself maybe contributes to the difficulty of reentry. Specifically, I have two thoughts. It seems to me that today we have more things that we determine are crimes. For example, I think in Champaign County we had a young lady that driving while talking on the cell phone killed a person. Very tragic event. Today we call that a crime and want to send this person to prison. In the past, we would have considered that an accident. Now, the prison system having a family member in there, I can't see how crimes like this. How once we put that person in the system, if we don't make it more difficult and more likely that when they do come out, that they do have a problem of reentry because the system itself creates a new or creates an environment where this individual, because of what they face in prison, now it becomes difficult for them to reenter society. Does your guest have any thoughts or comments on that?
Well, it's a terrific question. And let me just back it up one step. You have to ask yourself why it is the prison population has increased so much, as we said at the top of the show here. And there are a number of reasons. One is we keep people in prison longer. We've abolished parole or limited parole as a way of releasing people back into the community. We have more crimes that where we have, through our legislatures, established a mandatory minimum sentence. So for something that has always been defined as a crime, we now say if you're convicted of that crime, you have to do at least a year or more in prison. We have some, as the caller indicated, some areas of misconduct, social misconduct that we now define as criminal that maybe weren't in the past. But this, the point I want to drive home here is that these are all decisions made by our elected officials, by and large. It's not because crime has gone up that prison rates are high. Crime has come down. The prison rates have increased every year since 1972, when crime has gone up, when crime has gone down, when we've been at war, when we've been at peace, in good economic times, in bad economic times. So we've set up, as a country, we've set on this course that is where prison has become this independent sort of social phenomenon that's not rooted in or related to some of these other larger forces. So we have to ask ourselves really, really basic questions about why we decide to put so many of our citizens away, and that starts with why do we define some behavior as criminal, and what else, and what are our options? What else could we have done with a person that we now send in prison? How else could we have prevented crime rather than sending people to prison? These are tougher questions. It's easy, it's expensive, but it's easy to say, let's put them away. But the tougher questions are the ones that I think are more consistent with our values as a country, that we want to find ways to invest in solving conflicts differently, resolving the harms and the hurts caused by crime differently, and ultimately thinking about people as long-term members of our community rather than prisoners.
Well, I hope that gets at the comments of the caller. I want to thank him and go on here to someone else. This next listener is in Urbana, here where we are, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
It seems that having so many prisons, therefore having so many people working in prisons, that we basically are invested in recidivism. Otherwise, local economies would just fall apart. I mean, you have to keep up that prison population somehow.
Well, we had a very interesting sort of real-life example of your insight here in New York State. New York is one of the states in the country where the prison populations have declined a bit. I think it's maybe 8% or so over a number of years. And there was an option that came up before our state legislature in the spring budget process to actually close some prisons. And the legislators who represented the counties or the jurisdictions where those prisons were located basically got very upset because they would be losing the jobs and the contributions to the economy that those prisons represent. So it's an interesting sort of mental exercise to go through to ask ourselves, what would it look like if we were serious about reducing the prison population, and how would we create a different economy in those jurisdictions that now have prisons so that those economies can continue to thrive? And over what period of time would we want to reduce our prison population, and how would we reinvest the money that we're now spending on prisons? There's no state that's having that I'm aware of, that's having that sort of honest policy discussion. Because the easier thing, as the caller indicates, is to stay right where we are and to continue to fund prisons at the current level, even though it means that we're not funding public universities, we're not funding health care, we're not funding other needs that the public's entitled to have some investment. We're not making those investments because we are stuck. We're stuck with an enormous prison system.
We are a bit past our midpoint here, and I would like to introduce again our guest for anyone who might have tuned in. We're talking with Jeremy Travis. He's the president of John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. He's written a lot on constitutional law, criminal justice policy. We're talking about prisoner reentry. What sort of things can be done to help people reintegrate after they have been released from prison, the hope being that they will not end up going back? Before his appointment as president at John Jay, he was a senior fellow affiliated with the Justice Policy Center at the Urban Institute. And before that, he directed the National Institute of Justice. That's the research arm of the U.S. Department of Justice. And before that, he had a number of posts in the city of New York. He was deputy commissioner for legal matters for the New York City Police Department. And he has taught courses on criminal justice and public policy at a number of places, including Yale, New York University Wagner Graduate School of Public Service, New York Law School, George Washington University, and at John Jay College. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I know that here we wanted to try to make the focus of the conversation the business of reentry, but I suppose I do find myself thinking, as obviously some of the callers are, about the fact that if being in prison, we know that being in prison is can well be, and maybe we say it is, a psychologically damaging sort of thing, that people go into prison, they may have substance abuse issues, they may have deficits in terms of their education and their work experience, and that while they're in prison, we're not doing anything to try to address those. And it seems that if you could somehow build into the programming in the prison some substance abuse treatment and education, that you would give these folks a leg up, and maybe the issue of reentry would still be an issue, but maybe it wouldn't be as big a challenge as it is.
Some of my colleagues in the corrections profession have adopted a wonderful maxim to guide their work, which is reentry starts on day one, meaning the first day that somebody comes into prison, it's the obligation of the people running the prison system to start thinking about the inevitable fact that they'll return home, and starting to develop basically a plan for that moment. Now, if you were to think that way and start to sort of and I think it's unfortunate that in so many cases we have so many people in prison, but if we think that way and say, okay, they're in prison, how are we going to make best use of this time? Then I think we'd run very different prisons. We would run prisons that would focus on work. They would try to make sure that everybody is gainfully employed while in prison, doing productive work, developing skills, that they'd be trying to create what a colleague of mine called a parallel universe in prisons, of people who have jobs and do things that contribute to either the prison community or the larger community. They would be engaged in educational opportunities as if they were on the outside. You know, a lot of prisoners have low educational skills and need very basic literacy and remedial and GED types of courses. As you indicated in your question, the number of prison people come to prison with high rates of health problems. If you look at any major health problem in our country, whether it's HIV, AIDS, or hepatitis, or tuberculosis, or mental illness, or alcoholism, or drug addiction, sexually transmitted diseases, all of these health issues present at much higher rates, 4 to 10 times higher in the prison population. So, particularly for communicable diseases, this is a good time to start talking with people in prison about their behavior, about doing some, we would want to do some diagnostic work to see if they have these communicable diseases, so that we can intervene in a way that reduces both while in prison and outside, reduces those illnesses. And if you would set up this new world in a way that at the very tail end of this period of time of incarceration, you would focus on the reentry process itself. What does it mean to go back into your community? How do you think about staying away from negative peer influences? Let's talk about how you and your family are going to be reconnected. What does it mean that your son has grown up 5 years from 10 to 15 while you've been away, and now he's a young man and probably doesn't know you? How do we think about you know, some people have been away for 20 years and have difficulties dealing with ATM cards. So the the reorientation of the prison system to reflect the inevitability of reality would result in a very different prison system and very different public investments. And what's happened in our country has been just the opposite. We've reduced investments in programs that are linked to success on the outside because those are the easier budget cuts to make when you have to make budget cuts, and we pay a price with higher recidivism rates.
Yeah. Well, we have several callers here to talk with. Let's do that. Next up is someone in Champaign, line one. Hello?
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have experience with a particular population, the NGIs, not guilty by reason of insanity, in the state of California, where they have a specific program, and I worked as a combination parole officer and therapist. And we had a very low recidivism rate, and there were very specific reasons for that. We had a very small caseload, and we had intensive court-supervised activities and requirements that anyone in the program had to fulfill, which included regular contacts 3 to 4 times a week in the beginning, and supervision of everything from work to and placement at work, and supervision of housing and supervision of contacts, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very intrusive program, but a very high success rate, a very low recidivism rate, and cost-wise, you could imagine it was a lot cheaper than keeping someone in prison. And I think that's the other side of the equation of what you were just talking about in terms of investment from day one in prison. The other side is investment as soon as one is out of prison. So I'd be interested. Now, of course, that's a special population because it was NGI, but I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say on that, and I'll just get off and let you respond on air. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks. The caller makes 2 points. One is that we should think about investing in programs like the one he was affiliated with that have good track records that can stand as alternatives to sending somebody to prison, and that's particularly valuable in the case of individuals with mental illness, where the prison experience and being locked up in a small room for many hours a day, highly controlled environment, might actually be psychologically quite damaging to the individual. So we do need to, as a society, think about ways to create a number of different alternatives to this reflexive response we have of incarceration. And the second point he makes is that there are subpopulations within the prison population, within the large population of those currently incarcerated, and that we need to individualize and customize our approaches and responses to the particular challenges of those subpopulations. And that's absolutely an important observation. We tend to think very broad brush that everybody should be supervised in the same way, and it's just we would never treat a general population that way in terms of their health issues. So why do we treat a general population that way in terms of their criminal justice and other issues? So the reentry process, which is, as we were talking about before, best tied to what happens in prison, also has to be very customized to the unique circumstances and needs, and in this case, mental health conditions of the population. And that requires us to be much more differentiated in our programmatic interventions.
All right. Again, hope that gets at the question of the call. Let's talk with another listener. This is someone in Champaign in line 3. Hello.
Hello, I'm here.
Yes, go ahead.
My connection with the prison system is that I have worked as a psychiatrist in the Illinois system. And I also would count myself as a member of those faith communities that are trying to talk about this in another way with a new vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have a couple of comments. One comment I think is relevant is that we do know from studies that keeping family connections somewhat reduces recidivism, about 10%. But in Illinois, and I think most places, communities are very interested in having prison jobs. They aren't very interested in having the prisoners' children in their schools or the children's wives on the welfare rolls in their counties. And so there's a very consistent program of moving inmates around during their time in prison so that the family would never be able to figure out what town they're going to be in and stay close enough that they could visit every other weekend or something like that. The vast majority of prisoners come from northern Illinois. The vast majority of prisons are in southern Illinois. And so it's a huge trip for a family to invest to try to keep that connection. Recently, 3 years ago, the state legislature even decided that they weren't anymore going to provide stamps so that inmates could stay in touch by letter with their family, whereas previously stamps were provided. So we do some things that we actually can prove by research are working against recidivism. The other comment is look at the number of laws that prevent felons from being employed when you try to think about how they would restart employment. And then in Illinois, we have this particular situation that 80% of those released from prison go to 5 zip code zones in Illinois. So how you could ever imagine a program that would absorb that many felons in such a small geographic area is kind of overwhelming, and yet there's no county that says, oh, sure, send us some of the people who you don't want to send to those 5 zip code zones. We'd be glad to take people with a historic average of 68% recidivism rate. So we're a little bit caught in a bind there in terms of exactly where do you release people to where they would have a chance of making it. I just wanted to say that Illinois prisons have a pretty decent system of substance abuse treatment. They have a whole prison that's turned over specifically to that task. I'm not saying it's perfect, but they certainly have made steps in the right direction. They also do as good a job as any state prison system that I know about in terms of dealing with mental illness in the prison. There are still huge issues to deal with in terms of once a mentally ill person is released, actually keeping them on their medications, for example, and getting them into a local clinic. But that's more than I can talk about in a phone call.
Sure. So let me talk first about families and the importance of families, and then about the concentration of return in certain communities. The caller is absolutely right that family connections have been shown in a number of studies to be highly correlated with success. Success meaning both staying away from criminal behavior, but also success in terms of all the other measures of success that we use in our social yardsticks of getting jobs and staying together as a family and the like. Being married is an important predictor of what we call desistance, staying away from crime, and even more important is being in a good marriage. And that's not shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that these social connections are very important. And what we found at the Urban Institute when we did research in our one of our states where we did most of our research was in Illinois, and I'd encourage people to go to the Urban Institute website to look at some of these studies. But what we found that we documented really for the first time was the high expectations that people who were incarcerated had for the role that their families would play when they left prison, and that, in fact, families turned out to be very important in this equation of success. So then you go back to the caller's question, really, which is why is it, if that is true, that we put so many barriers in the way of successful family functioning, both during and after the period of incarceration? And this is another one of those deep questions. Well, why do we punish the kids when we intended to punish the dad? Why do we keep mom away from her husband when she goes away and make it difficult for him to see her? And you know, every state has its version of what the caller identified of these policies or these practices that sort of inhibit family functioning. An enlightened state, in my view, would be one that would say, let's turn this whole thing upside down and say, instead of why do we view everybody as a risk? Why not look at families as possible assets in successful reintegration? And yes, families do spend a lot of their household budgets when somebody's incarcerated on trying to keep contact. The collect call practices that exist around the country are really just, in my view, obscene, where we allow companies to place additional surcharges on collect calls from penitentiaries so that families are shouldering the burden of trying to keep that contact. So there are technological answers here. Some states have experimented with video links so that people can stay in touch with secure internet connections. Some states have, Texas, for example, has a summer camp program where they bring young people, children, to a place close to the prison to spend time with their mom or their dad. So I think we can turn all of that on its head and ask the question quite differently. On the issue of what we call communities of concentrated return, every state has what the caller identified and what the Urban Institute and my colleagues and I documented empirically, which is the pattern of large numbers of individuals who are incarcerated at the state level returning to small numbers of communities identified usually by zip codes. Those communities are being, in essence, asked to bear this enormous burden of reintegrating large numbers of men. It's 90% men who have been away for, on average, 2.5 to 3 years. Those communities now are taking on this social responsibility that we have given them because we have put so many more people in prison. And these are communities already struggling with poor school systems, poor health care, weak labor markets. They're communities of color. The communities themselves are stigmatized by high rates of incarceration. So large numbers of men, mostly, are coming back to these communities struggling, having difficulty getting reinvolved in crime, and having difficulty connecting to the workforce and to their families. So I'm proud to be associated with an initiative in Chicago funded by the MacArthur Foundation called Safer Return, which is a project of the Safer Foundation, a premier reentry and employment agency, that's asking the question, how can communities be viewed as partners in the reintegration effort, and how can we use community assets to try to reduce the rates of failure, promote positive reintegration? And we hope to learn a lot from this and hope to have a lot of successes. But what we know now is that these small number of communities in every state, and every state has the same pattern, are absorbing this era of mass incarceration and reentry of large numbers of men being arrested, sent away, sent back, supervised, parole revoked, sent away, sent back, and this cycling in and out is doing a lot of damage.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and our interest in doing this program was not only to talk about a problem, but to indicate that there at least was some shift of focus here, and that there was more attention being given to the issue of reentry. Is it possible for a couple of minutes that you can talk about some place where you think that they have a program that's particularly innovative and successful and serves as a good model?
Well, the most important recent development in the field is the enactment of the Second Chance Act.
Mm-hmm.
That was promoted by President Bush based on his 2004 State of the Union address, where he called America, in very eloquent language, the land of the second chance, where people are given opportunities after they have served their time. And the idea was taken up in the House by Representative Portman, and your local representative, Danny Davis, from Chicago, was the one of the maybe the preeminent champion of the Second Chance Act. So last month, that act was passed by both houses, signed by the president, and it commits the federal government to try to find ways to promote successful reentry and reintegration. There's a funding initiative part of it. We hope there'll be appropriated dollars coming soon. There's demonstration projects to be. So it really puts our national government on the side of promoting successful reentry. And every state in the country has a version of that story, where the governor or the legislature or the corrections commissioner has created a task force to promote successful reentry. So the question then is, what would they want to do differently that would improve chances of success from the past? And here the research literature and the sort of the innovations process is just now starting to pick up steam. We've not spent a lot of time thinking about how to do these things differently. We're going to need years to test new ideas. But here are some things that I think are particularly promising. A number of states are experimenting with ways to connect people to health care when they come out of prison. That turns out to be highly valuable. A number of states are experimenting with different ways to promote positive family support systems when people come out. A number of states, including Chicago, as I just mentioned, are promoting ways to experiment with transitional employment so that there's some job waiting for people when they come out, even if supported by public dollars, to give somebody a way to get back on their feet for a period of time. And here we're learning a lot of lessons from the welfare reform movement that had a similar goal of trying to promote economic independence. One of the areas where there's the most robust research literature is in the area of drug treatment. As I mentioned before, high rates of relapse for people when they come out of prison, return to drug use or alcohol abuse. And the research has shown that drug treatment regimes that start in prison and continue when somebody goes back home and work on the relapse prevention are highly successful at reducing crime and reducing the return to drug use. Mm. So there's an emerging body of literature, and what we need to do is not put it all together and as I said, front load the resources to the time when somebody is just coming back home.
There we will have to leave it. Our guest, Jeremy Travis, is the president of John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York and is the author of the book, But They All Come Back, Facing the Challenges of Prisoner Reentry, published by the Urban Institute Press. And Dr. Travis, thank you very much.
You're very welcome, David. I appreciated it.